This is the TriDot Podcast. TriDot uses your training data and genetic profile combined with predictive analytics and artificial intelligence to optimize your training, giving you better results in less time with fewer injuries. Our podcast is here to educate, inspire, and entertain. We'll talk all things triathlon with expert coaches and special guests. Join the conversation and let's improve together.
Episode 186 of the TriDot Podcast, and it's with two guys who have been on here since the beginning. We'll be talking through preparing for your next event, specifically through learning what you can from the athlete guide and whatever other materials your race might equip you with heading into the event. Joining us for this conversation is TriDot coach Jeff Raines. Jeff is a USAT Level 2 and Ironman U certified coach, and a founding TriDot Master Coach who is a Master of Science in Exercise Physiology and was a D1 collegiate runner. He has over 50 Ironman event finishes to his credit and has coached hundreds of athletes to the Ironman finish line. No day like race day, eh, Jeff?
That's right. A day like no other. The moment we've all been waiting for to put everything to the test. Gotta love race day.
Also joining us is TriDot Coach John Mayfield. John is a USAT Level 2 and Ironman U certified coach who is an expert on the North America Ironman scene. As an athlete, he has double-digit Ironman finishes on his resume, and as a coach, he's worked with hundreds of athletes ranging from first-timers to Kona qualifiers and professional triathletes. John has been using TriDot since 2010 and coaching with TriDot since 2012. Now, John, longtime listeners of the show, if they have a keen ear, they will notice there was a slight change to your show bio there. After many admirable years of service, you have stepped down from your full-time role at TriDot in order to focus more on coaching triathletes full-time. You will absolutely continue to be a voice on the podcast and a face on the TriDot Triathlon show on YouTube. So, John, just for our listeners who have connected with you and know you and love you, why was this the right time for this change for you?
So coaching athletes has always been a passion of mine. It was what began to transition me from my banking career into what became a long career and fulfilling venture on the TriDot staff. And over the last couple of years, I really wanted to get back to that, fulfilling that passion of working with the individual athletes and focusing on that. I've continued to coach athletes over the last several years, but in a much diminished role, just a handful of athletes. And really what made the timing right was just where TriDot is as an organization. So over the last several years, there's been several features and different things we've wanted to add to the app. It's largely built out now. It's really a complete thing that's really robust, and it's at a great place. Same thing with the TriDot staff. In the beginning, it was just Jeff Boer and myself doing everything, and you know, I came from a career in banking, so I was kind of winging a lot of stuff. But now we've had the opportunity to hire some folks that actually know what they're doing, that are specialized in different things. And, you know, the staff is really in a great place with some really highly qualified individuals, running the show. The community is absolutely amazing. Now over 1,000 ambassadors, with so many things going on. It's just, everything is so robust. I think it just provided me the opportunity to step back from that and once again pursue my passion of working with individuals and coaching them to whatever it is that they're wanting to do.
Yeah, I'm very excited for you, just as your friend and someone who's done a ton of traveling for TriDot with you, alongside of you. I've been in the truck with you. I've been on planes with you. I've been on site at races with you and watched you communicate with your athletes, coach your athletes, talk to your athletes. You obviously love your athletes and love getting them through the day-to-day training and getting them ready for race day. And so, folks, if you have heard John Mayfield on the podcast and you're like, man, that guy sounds like he knows what he's talking about, he is expanding his roster of athletes right now. Andrew, the average triathlete, myself, I am a John Mayfield coach athlete. Cannot recommend this guy enough. On with today's show. As I said, I'm Andrew, the average triathlete, voice of the people and captain of the middle of the pack. As always, we'll approach the show like any good workout. We'll roll through our warm-up question, settle in for our main set conversation, and then wind things down with our cool down. Lots of good stuff. Let's get to it.
Time to warm up. Let's get moving.
Not at all a triathlon question, although I suppose the answer could be multi-sport related. But this warm-up question is one that I'm curious to hear you guys' answers to. What is an everyday common task that you are simply, absolutely, horrendously horrible at? Like just you as a functioning adult should never be the adult charged with completing this ordinary task. I never go first on these. I always let the guests go first and I go last. But since this one is kind of a public embarrassment question, I will go first here. I am absolutely horrendous at cracking eggs. It's a very normal thing. It's a very day-to-day thing. Every single day, all over the world, people crack eggs and cook them for breakfast, lunch, dinner. I should never be the adult in the room cracking the eggs for cooking breakfast. I can do it in a pinch. I can get by. I have ended up with egg on my shirt. I've ended up with egg on the floor. I've ended up with egg, a foot down the counter somehow. I don't know. It looks pretty basic. Looks like it should be pretty simple. I am horrendous at doing it. I have a very high percentage rate of having, even when the cracking itself goes fairly well.
Have you bit into an eggshell in the middle of your meal because of that?
No, I am very OCD. And that's what I was about to say. I do usually end up with a small piece or two of shell in my cracked egg, and I'm very good about fishing it out with my finger. It takes a little time. I'm probably better at that than I am cracking the egg itself. So very ordinary everyday thing. And I ended up with some egg on the floor the other day. And I was like, this needs to be a warm-up question. I need to find out what our guests are horrible at doing. So Jeff Rains, over to you. What's your answer here?
Man, I think many dads are going to agree with me on this one, but having three kiddos, 2, 4, and 6 years old, get ready, Andrew, car seats. I just want to go on the record and say, even though I am indeed in charge of the kid car seats, I do put them in, but I loathe having to put those suckers in the car. And I've been doing it for almost 7 years now. And I kind of finally have a system down to get those things in and out. But man, they frustrate me. I always get so mad hooking them, strapping them. I can't reach. I can't get it to fit. And oh man, car seats. Ugh. I always throw in a second twist to it all. So I'm going to add the dishwasher. It's not that I can't use a dishwasher. I know how. They're very simple. They're great.
Yeah, sure.
But I never use it. Sarah uses it. My wife uses it. I always hand wash all of my dishes. I don't like the dishes just like sitting in the sink or dishwasher, right?
Sure, yeah.
Like I can't even go to bed at night if there's a sink full of dishes. I just like to have them clean, but I could just throw them all in the dishwasher and go to bed 30 seconds, right? But man, I don't like going, hey, I need a fork. And I go to the clean drawer of forks and there's none in there. They're all in the dishwasher. I don't know. I don't know what it is, but I do not use a dishwasher.
Okay, yeah, this is already, this warm-up question is already just getting some great insight into y'all's daily lives and my own as well. John Mayfield, over to you. What do you got?
Man, I agree wholeheartedly with Jeff on that one. I hated getting the car seats in and out, but also getting the kids in and out of the car seats, like especially like in our Texas summers when it's a billion degrees and you're trying to, you know, like they're squirming and all. Like I hated that so much. So one, it was great when they could like buckle themselves in. And then two, it was even more amazing when they just didn't need them anymore. And now like my youngest is like weeks away from driving her own car. So like you've been told, fellas, it comes quick. So and yes, it is amazing when they can drive themselves. Kind of that. Man, so I actually asked my wife this
that's
and
a
she
good
came
call.
Up with so many.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, I was like, hey, Cole, what am I not
shout
good
out
at?
To Nicole Mayfield.
Like, I don't know if we have time for this, but it all kind of just summed up in just being the adult. Like when it comes time to be serious and get things done, I can switch it over. But kind of like my default is like I'm not the best adult. I'm just kind of like a big kid. Like if anyone ever says, hey, let's go do something, I'm always down. Kind of spontaneous. I'm kind of fun. Like, and my wife is kind of that way too. So like, you know, we maybe don't have quite as much in the savings account or in the college fund as we would like, but, we've got lots of cool memories and that sort of thing. So, yeah, just, I don't know. Maybe I just shouldn't be the adult, in charge.
All right, we're going to kick this over to our audience. I'm curious to hear what everyday common tasks you are horrible at. So make sure you're part of the I Am Triathlete Facebook group. Tens of thousands of triathletes just talking swim, bike, and run every single day on that group. And Monday, when this episode comes out, I will throw this question out to you. What is a everyday task you are horrible at completing? Cannot wait to see what public embarrassment awaits our audience.
On to the main set. Going in 3, 2, 1.
Ketones are nature's superfuel, and the Delta-G ketone ester created by Professor Kieran Clark at Oxford University is the world's first drink that delivers the exact ketone produced naturally in the body. When I talk to triathlon athletes who are already using Delta-G drinks in their training and racing, they all rave about the spark of energy and the mental clarity the ketones provide. Some athletes are taking Delta-G performance on the side of their carbohydrate source. Others are mixing in Delta-G tactical with their nutrition. Both ways are highly effective. So however you approach nutrition, there is a Delta-G drink that can mix seamlessly into your flow. The team at Delta-G even offer free 15-minute one-on-one consultations where you can learn the best way to supercharge your nutrition routine with Delta-G ketones. So head to their website, deltagketones.com, to learn more about fueling with Delta-G and to book your free 15-minute consultation. When you place an order, use code TRIDOT20 to get 20% off your Superfuel ketone drinks. Everyone loves race day, but for race day to love you back, you've got to put a little work into the relationship. Every event you do will be different, and thus, every good event should issue you some form of an athlete guide. The weather, the course, the placement of the aid stations, the contents of the aid stations, the orientation of transition, the logistics of the race location, the event schedule, it all should be in there. And if you familiarize yourself with these contents, you and race day should have a grand old time together. John, Jeff, before you gentlemen guide us on all things race logistics, hit us with a good story. What was a time where you or one of your athletes just totally botched something practical that was probably covered in the athlete guide?
So I think I actually already shared this story on the podcast, and this was something that I totally botched, and it's hard to botch anything worse than this. Last summer, I showed up to a race, went down to registration to pick up my packet, and at first, they didn't have my name, couldn't find it. I thought, no big deal. It's been many months since I registered, and went to like the other table, and come to find out, like, yeah, I never registered. So, you know, it's hard to do anything or really none of these logistics matter if you haven't actually registered for the race. And this is one I actually traveled to. So I drove like 3 hours, stayed in the hotel, all that. So it wasn't just like, you know, a race around the corner, but fortunately I was able to sign up there. But yeah, like here I am, experienced coach, been doing this for a long time, triple digit races, and I guess at some point you just assume that they automatically register for you. But yeah, so that was a good one. And one that this is not so much race logistics, but it all kind of is. I had an athlete years ago who I was tracking at Ironman Arizona. I was there with him. He was out on the run course. He had done really well, swim, bike, first loop of the run, and then just kind of like disappeared. And it's like, you know, what's going on? It took forever to find him. Finally, he shows up in the med tent, DNF'd after having a really great start to the race. And he's like, yeah, my blood sugar crashed.
Wow.
And hey, I've been coaching this guy for months. Yeah, I'm diabetic. And if I don't manage it really closely and manage my insulin and all that, my blood sugar will crash. And then it's like, and this was the first time I'd heard this. Like, we'd had numerous conversations about all sorts of things. And it's like, you never thought to tell me this,
by the
like,
way.
We didn't have a plan for it. Like, it was frustrating that he had DNF'd after such a great start. But yeah, it's like something we could have just managed. We could have mitigated this. But like such a major thing to not tell the coach. And it was disappointing. It was sad, but it was also pretty frustrating.
I think it's very, very easy when you start doing a lot of triathlons to forget how intentional you have to be about being ready for every step of the race, from literally registering for the race in your case to all the different things you have to do to be ready for in the morning and then pre-race, post-race, T1, T2. There's just so many things to think through and have ready. this isn't in relation to like the athlete guide or the course logistics, but I had a race recently. I did PTO Dallas last year, and I, as an experienced triathlete, I did not charge my DI2 the night before. And all of a sudden I am probably 2 miles into my 13-ish mile bike ride for PTO Dallas, and my DI2 completely dies. And I had one gear for the rest of the race. So you cannot take for granted whatever race you are doing next. It doesn't care if you're a 10-time Ironman. It doesn't care if you have done 300 triathlons before. If you have not done your due diligence to be ready for that race, it doesn't matter how experienced you are. So Jeff Raines, same question over to you. What is something that you or an athlete have botched simply because you just weren't quite ready for that particular race?
There's a ton. I've got a huge list. There's, you know, we say that you can't plan on race day going perfectly, because if you do, you're going to be disappointed, right? We have to prepare for the what ifs or the curveballs that are thrown at us on race day. So it's how we will respond to some sort of a potential issue is what we're preparing for. But at the same time, we want to be as prepared as possible, but we also have to be able to respond accordingly and adapt and still have a great race day and not let it ruin the day. But it's not kind of one of those, you know, ifs, it's when, right? But I've had a couple races where it's on us to know the course, the bike course and run course. There's been races true. Where, you know, I took a wrong turn or something like that. And it costed me the podium, but that's on me. I should have known the course. Well, I did have a race where I happened to be leading the bike and I'm just following the pace setter vehicle out in front of me. And that person took me down the wrong street.
Wow.
So it's like, well, I think I was supposed to turn left there, but I'm following the lead car. So it's like, what do I do? What do I do? So I've had circumstances like that. And I think a big one, and I actually saw this yesterday, you know, the Ironman Texas is coming up in just a few days. And I saw on the forum, very fitting for this episode, someone just said and posted on the forum, hey, I'm just reading through the athlete guide and holy cow, the race is Saturday. I thought this whole time it was Sunday.
Wow.
And so now they have to change their hotel or try to get another day because we have to be there at least 2 days or further out from an Ironman. And one of my athletes at Ironman California had a unique circumstance where it's not his fault, but his father was in the ER and he couldn't arrive 2 days earlier. And so there are races, although even though there are those rules, there are exceptions. And so they let me, his coach, go to Tri-Bike Transport, get his bike. They let me go get his packet. So the day before the race, they still let him come in, arrive on site, and still race. It all worked out. But there's always unique circumstances.
Yeah, and the more prepared you are, the more you studied your athlete guide, the more you know about your race and the race schedule and the race course and all that, the better prepared you are to navigate when things like that pop up. So great stories, guys. Now, every race director and every race producer, they provide different forms of content before a race. I mean, often it's an athlete guide that's emailed to the athlete. Sometimes it's printed when you do packet pickup. Sometimes it's maps and event schedules just on a website somewhere. Some races have on-site briefings. Some races have YouTube video material. From y'all's just vast race experience, what have you seen over the years that stood out for better or for worse? Jeff Raines.
I really like when a race will kind of have their own phone app where everything is just placed in that app. If there are changes to a course or updates, it's not, you know, just maybe a...
See, I don't like that because then I have to go download another app.
I do get
and
that.
And delete that other app after the race.
Totally understand that. But like at the same time, if there's a course change or something like that, it can get lost in an email. And
yeah,
if it's
I get
2 weeks
you.
Before the race, it's like, I got to go back, find it in that email. What was that change? But I also understand that a lot of maybe smaller, newer race budgeting, funding, you know, they're not able to have super, super in-depth, you know, apps or even race guides. And so I always like races that show the nutrition they're going to have on course.
Yes.
And then parking. Race morning, you're kind of on edge. You want to get down there, get set up. And, you know, if you're in a super long line of cars or you knew some back road or, hey, there's a better lot over here and it saves you that anxiety. Parking maps are great.
I, Jeff, am the millennial who, and I saw this on a tweet. I can't take credit for this. I saw it on a tweet somewhere where it was like, I am at the age now where I will decide whether I'm going to go to a social function I've been invited to based on the parking situation. But if there's easy parking, whether free or paid, I'll even pay for it. Just as long as it's easy in, easy out, I'm game to go. So yeah, I always like it when a race shows you, and a lot of the races here are very, very good about that. You know, here are the available parking garages. Here's the available lots, this grass field, that Kroger, this whatever. It's always really, really nice when they point out, because that just takes one stressor from your morning off the table.
Just, I could go on and on, but I'll just throw out one more, and I'm interested to hear John's thoughts. But I like races that have like a specific host hotel, because race morning, typically you won't have to drive to this race site. But a big thing is in the athlete guide, if it says that host hotel has late checkout, that's a huge step, because I'll usually call, you know, a couple hotels in the area of a race that I like to do and just ask if they're offering anything special for racers or late checkout. Do I have to pay extra? You know, can I shower after the race before I have that drive home? Stuff like that. That's always a perk.
I see. Unfortunately, there's really oftentimes a lack of quality information, especially from the races that are more inclined for new triathletes to be doing. So it's one thing for us. I mean, we have a pretty good feel for what's going to happen on race morning. We have our routines down. So for us as experienced triathletes, as long as we've registered for the race, it's not as important to have all those details further out. But I will say that a lot of times these local sprint races, you know, they may have the maps, things like that for the course, but not a whole lot of logistical information. So I wish that there was more of that. I don't know if it's just an assumption that these athletes know, not exactly sure why not, but then it's kind of almost the inverse. Whereas you go to a race like a 70.3 or Ironman, and generally you have just a whole lot more information. Like Escape from Alcatraz starts months out. The extreme triathlons start months out with webinars and information and all sorts of things to prepare the participants for it. But there's just not that same level of resources, unfortunately, available to newer athletes. So I think it's important what we do, and I think that's one of the things that we strive for is providing that education. I wish that. And not all. I mean, there are some. The first triathlon I ever did, they had a beginner clinic that I went to, and it was fantastic.
That's awesome.
So there are some that do better than others.
So to your point, John, at the local sprint and Olympic level, it is totally hit or miss what these race directors are providing you with. Some of them have very thorough information, and it's good quality course maps, accurate aid station placements and listings of what's going to be at them and all that jazz. And some of them, it's show up at this time. You're going to start at this time. Oh, cool. Thanks so much. And so we as athletes obviously have to do our due diligence to find everything we can find. I mean, absolutely look at the race website. Absolutely, you know, see what emails they send you. Absolutely, when you go to packet pickup, see what they can provide you with, and get all the information you can to be ready. So obviously, this is going to depend somewhat on what your race provides. But as coaches, what do you guys make sure your athletes look at as they prep for an event?
I would say the most important variable to consider headed into the race is the weather. As we prepare for the race, you know, obviously we're getting our fitness there, we're getting our training in, but the weather really has a massive impact on everything. So again, primarily the temperature, which that's going to affect the gear that you're selecting. So like what kit you're going to wear, you know, is it something you're trying to be as cool as possible? Or are you trying to be as warm as possible? Is there rain in the forecast, which, you know, that can affect, again, your gear that you're using, your tire pressure, all of that. And then wind as well, which is it's a bit more difficult to predict. Sometimes you don't really know till you're out there, but you know, that's going to have a big impact on your day as well. And I would say from there, the biggest impact is obviously it has a big impact on pacing, but nutrition, I would say, is really the biggest thing that the weather is going to impact. Is what I found over the years is that there's really nothing more important than staying up on your hydration, your electrolytes, and your nutrition. If you get behind on those, it doesn't matter how well you trained. It doesn't matter how fit, how fast. If you're behind on nutrition, hydration, electrolytes, you're never going to perform to your best. And again, weather obviously has a huge impact.
Yeah, absolutely.
On that. So paying attention to the forecast, what adjustments to those do we need to make? What gear adjustments, what nutrition, hydration, electrolyte adjustments do we need to make? And then course logistics. You know, this is really where we get into a a big variance of those. Some courses are very technical and have a ton of stuff that need to be taken into consideration. You know, what are the potential variables on the swim that we need to account for, the bike, the run? You know, when you get into some true open water where you have currents and waves, all that, you get into very technical bike courses where you can have ascents and descents, sharp turns. And then same thing on your runs, we have, you know, some hilly technical courses, or maybe it's different surfaces that you're going to be running on. You don't want to be surprised by any of those things. So all those need to be taken into consideration.
Are you going to transport your bike? You know, how are you going to get your bike there? What hotel are you going to stay in? Is there a bus that gets you right race morning even, right? The logistics just of getting there and getting to the race site race morning even. And then, you know, the type of course, like, is it most likely going to be wetsuit legal? If not, are you prepared for that? Are you prepared to swim a particular distance without that wetsuit on? So there's just so many things, but, you know, on, you know, what the race day provides, like once you have all those logistics, something that I make sure that they prep for are those different scenarios. You make sure that you're ready for any scenario. If it's usually a cold race, but it happens to have a really warm front, you know, come through the week of the race, well, you may want to tone down the effort you're going to push, you know, percent of FTP, your pacing is going to change, your nutritional intake is going to change. So a big one is kind of that nutrition piece. And where in kind of those traditional ranges will they end up on race day based on kind of the conditions and everything that, that John was mentioning earlier. You know, we want to train for the high end of the ranges, but then, we will taper that down or race, you know, maybe lower end of the range. You may want a little bit less salt, a little bit less, maybe grams of carbs per hour if it's going to be a cooler, less demanding day. But if it happens to just be a unique, crazy last minute, oh man, it's a heat wave, it's going to be miserable out there. Well, if you're not used to taking in an extra 20, 30 grams of carbs per hour or something like that, you don't want to have GI issues on race day. So training the gut for the worst case scenario, and then hoping for the best in the moment.
Okay, so for our athletes listening, the important thing there, so ahead of time, as we're looking at the information, we want to look at the weather. We were talking, there's a ton of implications there for your nutrition and what you're going to need. Look at the course logistics, look at what they're going to provide in terms of aid at the aid stations. Because to a certain extent, you know, you can't, unless you're Jeff Raines and you're in the lead on the bike, like you can just hop in the water and follow the feet in front of you. You can just hop out of the water, get on your bike and follow the bike in front of you. And you can just follow the runners in front of you. But knowing the weather, thinking through what you're going to need in terms of staying fueled for that race effort, it's going to be a real bad day if you don't do that. So let's truck through the items that most events will be providing to their athletes. And again, we've already established it's going to totally vary based on what race you're doing and how thorough the race producer is. But we're going to talk through a lot of the things that races will or might provide for you. And we're going to cover just what you can learn from those items that are provided. So the first thing I want to talk about is the course maps. On the surface, you glance at it and you get a sense of the layout and the elevation profile for the course. But what does a nuanced eye pick up here? When you guys are looking at a course map and you're heading into a race and you're talking through with your experienced athletes, okay, here's the map, here's what you need to think through, here's the elevation gain. What can we learn just beyond where we're going?
Things that I like to look at kind of inside that course, you know, are there no passing zones? There's a lot of races, certain hills or descents, you know, trying to keep the course safe. You need to know where those no passing zones are. That could hinder what place you're in, or if you get stuck behind somebody, and then obviously you want to be safe. There's other races where there might be unique areas on the course, like low water crossings. There might be bridges, overpasses that are unique. Cattle guards, are there sharp turns? Looking at the course maps, you know, where are the aid stations and how many? Those crazy more technical areas of the course, you've got to think about where the wind direction is usually coming from as well. Is half the race going to be potentially a miserable headwind? Just things like that. We have kind of a ranking system in our Tridot RaceX where it kind of ranks the course and how kind of open it is. Is it like an open plain? Is it a coastal where you might get some coastal winds? Is it wooded forest areas? If 90% of the course is kind of in trees, then you don't have to worry a lot about wind. You could get away with sitting up a little bit more potentially, not having to stay super narrow. Just things like that. Like shade is another one. If it's a hot race, how much of the course is shaded? Are the roads narrow? Are they smooth? We also have a road kind of smoothness ranking system in our RaceX that helps you with your pacing. Is it open to traffic? A lot of people like to know that their race course is closed to traffic and they don't have to worry about cars. That's a big deal for a lot of people.
Yeah,
a lot of courses aren't fully closed to traffic. There's just so many things. The last thing is the elevation gains. Where are those big hills, those ascents, those descents? When are you going to eat? Are you able to have good bike handling during those unique aspects of the course? A lot of people like... There's this super fast, long 30-minute descent, and you're flying downhill. You may not want to or even be able to grab a bottle, take a drink, or eat that gel in the moment. And so you're going to have to kind of time your eating and nutrition based on some of those aspects of the course. So a lot to think about for sure.
Yeah, really interesting stuff there, Jeff. And I want to point out for folks that even beyond, so looking at the course map and kind of thinking through what is that spot on planet Earth actually like? Because it's very easy to say, oh yeah, Galveston, for example, 70.3 Galveston. You look at the course map, the bike route is just a simple out and back. But you start considering what that road is like, being right next to the beach. It's always really windy. And so being on that road on planet Earth, it's a flat, smooth road, sure, but one direction is going to be really windy. One direction is going to have a massive tailwind. And to your point, there are some fueling ramifications for that. There is some pacing, you know, knowing that the whole way out is going to be really difficult and the whole way back is going to be a lot easier in terms of just energy expenditure. So for your race course, however it's laid out, just looking at what is that road like? What is that spot like? If you're running in an area where it's just very, very still, not very windy, and it's going to be very hot, that's going to be very different from running on under some trees where it's shaded. Looking at the map, and I like to go to Google Earth actually, and I will, if I can go to a race site and I can drive the course first, that's always preferred. But if I can't do that, I like to just click the route on like Google Maps and follow along and just to see what that road looks like. And that even helps me my race visualization and just knowing that, oh, I've seen this overpass before. I've seen this hill before. I've seen this patch of road before, because even on Google Earth, I clicked through this route to see what those spots on planet Earth look like, because there's going to be some ramifications for what it feels like when you're actually there. So it's something we tell athletes all the time. If we can go to our race venue ahead of time and drive the bike course or maybe bike the run course in advance, it sounds smart. It makes sense. What should we pay attention to if we get the chance to do that?
So heading down to the swim venue, it's great if you can do that around the time that you're going to be in the water. So a primary consideration here is, you know, where is the sunrise in relation to the swim course? You know, are you going to be swimming into the sunrise? Is it going to be on your dominant breathing side? So things like that can factor into your goggle selection. And then also keep an eye on, you know, what are the current conditions and how do those compare to the forecast? So if it's equal wind as forecasted for race day, look at how much chop is on top of the water. Are there currents? Are there waves? Which way are they coming from? All those kinds of things that you can begin to strategize. If you see that every day that there's a decent amount of chop that is on your predominant breathing side, then maybe it's time to switch your strategy to breathe to your non-dominant side. Otherwise, you're going to be getting a face full of water time you turn to breathe. So these are the kinds of things that we want to consider prior to the race. And if we don't take those into consideration, it's going to make for hardship on race day. Headed out on the bike course, as Rain's mentioned, we're really looking for the technical areas. Are there any tight turns? What are the climbs like? What are the descents? What are the bad roads? Some races do a better job of marking things like potholes and things like that than others. Certainly, you don't want to catch a pothole or anything like that out there on race day. Oftentimes, especially in the bigger races, Ironman races, especially the aid stations and personal needs are marked. in the days leading into the race. You'll know exactly where those are, so you can kind of plan your strategy. And that's really what we're looking for. We don't want any surprises on race day. We want to be aware of what we're going to encounter. If there's anything out there that poses a threat, we want to be able to have a strategy or at least be prepared for it. I did not make it out onto the bike course prior to racing Ironman Des Moines last year. And I was kind of caught off guard, and it really kind of messed with me. I did not enjoy that bike course. From the elevation chart that I saw, I was expecting much more of a rolling course that was kind of up and down the whole time. Not a whole lot of climbing, and it wasn't a climbing course, but I was caught off guard by kind of how steep and how long some of the ascents were. And it wasn't difficult. I was able to get through the course fine. It just wasn't what I was expecting. I had surprises on race day, and that's one of those things I preach is no surprises on race day.
Yep, I've certainly had some as well. I when I'm taking those kind of course recon trips, I like looking at the road quality for sure. You know, seeing where that chip seal is, seeing where the road is smooth, just making mental notations of that, because that's just a mental thing, right? If there's a patch of rough road, you just got to mentally be ready for it. It's just no fun to get to kind of truck through those. And it's good to know where they are. It's good to know how much of that you have to deal with, as opposed to just, you know, getting on some chip seal and being like, is it going to be like this forever? Or is it like this for a mile? But driving the course and kind of learning that is always good. Something you guys mentioned is that many courses will put the actual placement of the aid stations on the map. It's easy to see where they are and kind of move on with your life. They typically are placed at fairly regular intervals. And so it kind of is what it is, right? So sometimes I pay attention to this a lot. Sometimes I just kind of glance at it. Is there any nutritional strategy we should have in mind as we look at the aid station placement in the list of what they're going to have at those aid stations?
Definitely. I don't like to fully rely on what is there, you know, on course. I like that. I like knowing that it's there as kind of an insurance policy, but you know, we've had races before, you know, at least I have, where they've run out of things. They're out of ice, or hey, those gels that were promised, they're all gone, or they're on the way. Well, you know, I need it now, you know, kind of things like that. So I like to be a little bit more self-sufficient on my nutritional strategy. But yeah, you're going to plan those nutritional intakes, usually on better, safer areas of the course. We talked a little bit about, you know, not relying on, hey, at this time period, I've got to have this many calories in. But if that's on a long descent, like we talked about, and it's not safe, you don't want to go potentially 30 minutes without eating until you get to the bottom of that hill. So you'd want to time that nutritional intake, on those safer, better areas of the course. You know, this one's kind of, overlooked or maybe not super relied upon, but like some races you can access personal needs more than once, at more than one mileage opportunity. Some races just straight up say, hey, if you have a personal needs area, typically are for these longer races, where there's an opportunity for you to stop and there's a bag that has been sent out onto the course in that designated spot, and it's waiting for you. It's your unique own food that you've prepared ahead of time that is waiting for you at a certain part. You know, trail races, for example, might have a bunch of multiple loops, and so you can access that many, many times. Some races say you're only supposed to do it once. But there are races where, you know, that you might have an opportunity to take that twice. And I am always an advocate of taking it sooner rather than later. But also, if it is offered more than once, to definitely take advantage of that. Something to consider also is like taking the tangents. Let's say you're a standalone half marathon, let's just say, and you don't have to access every single aid station every single mile if you don't want to. So I might skip an aid station if it's not on a perfect tangent. Right. If I got a sharp left-hand turn coming up, I don't want to run, you know, to the right really far on the other side of the road, you know, add 10 seconds to my race, grab the drink, and then come back and add distance to the race as well. So things like that, you know, if you can get away with it and you know it's safe and okay, you might want to skip an aid station. Even though I'm not in an Ironman or long course, I like to utilize something at every aid station. But there are certain times where you might want to skip that.
So along those same lines, I'm an advocate for, especially on the run, I tell athletes, take something at every aid station, because there's always something that you're going to need by that point. But especially, again, most of the races that we do are warm weather. controlling our core temperature is critical. So I always say, if there is an opportunity to take a cold water bottle, always do that at that aid station. So knowing where that is and beginning to prepare for it so you can get over. Maybe it's clearing out a cage. Maybe it's throwing throwing out a bottle that you're going to be replacing, because that's kind of that rule of thumb. You may have half a bottle of water left, but it's going to be warm by then. So ditch that warm water bottle and get some fresh cold water. Pour it over your body, get some cold water down to control your or help cool your core temperature from the inside. So again, just knowing where those are. And then same thing on that run course. If nothing else, it may just be pouring a cup of water over your head or dumping some ice down your kit, or it may be sticking to your nutrition plan. But knowing where those aid stations are is going to be important in your planning and your execution.
And I definitely time my nutrition knowing where those aid stations are. If I know an aid station's coming up in a half mile on the bike, I might start taking a gel on the bike so that I can, you know, wash it down or rinse it. Or on the run, if I'm going to pop a salt pill, I might take it right before the aid station.
Yeah, great point.
So I can wash it down with water. And we've all been there, so I'm going to say this, but I'll pee on the bike knowing there's an aid station up ahead. If I can see it way up there, I might time my
it's potty time.
On the bike restroom just so I can rinse immediately afterwards. So things like that definitely help.
Sure. I think the biggest thing I try to note, whether it's full distance, middle distance, or short course, is just how far apart are those aid stations? What are the intervals? Because I mean, normally they're, to your point, normally you have one by the time you need one. But there are races where they are a little bit farther apart than is preferable. And I like to notate that. I might take just a small handheld water bottle if that's going to be the case. I might take a gel or something in transition if there's not going to be an aid station pretty quickly after transition. So just noting that how far apart they are is kind of a crucial thing that I always like to look at as well. So let's talk about the schedule for a race weekend. Race info should absolutely give a comprehensive schedule for something like a local sprint. I mean, everything might just be on the day of the race itself, from packet pickup to the time transition's open and the time transition is closed to the time you're in the water. It's all within 2 hours sometimes. And so that's all it is. Pretty straightforward for a local sprint. For middle distance, for long course, I mean, this could be a full on long weekend. So as we look through the schedule, what needs to jump out at us? What will become a race weekend blunder if we don't catch it on the schedule?
A huge thing is something that Rains mentioned earlier, is having that check-in deadline. This is something we see pretty much at every race. And it's one of those just like mind-numbing, like head scratcher. How did you miss this? But inevitably every race, like I saw somebody different than what Rains was referring to with Ironman Texas coming up, saying, you know, they're arriving on Friday. It's like, well, you can't. And this has been out there for, you know, since you've signed up. So that is absolutely critical. I would say that's the biggest is Ironman. That is kind of the one little caveat is generally they do require 2 days out from the race. Most other races will have packet pickup available the day before, some even the morning of, which I'm not really a big fan of, but you know, if it works for you and that's what you have to do. And then things like bike drops, some races require it, some offer it, some don't. So just know that. Do you have to drop your bike off the day before? Can you drop your bike off the day before? Is that something that you want to do? Or is it only available on race morning? And then something really to consider too is race morning traffic.
Yeah.
We often, now a lot of times getting to the venue is great because it's, you know, very early on a Saturday or Sunday morning and there's not a whole lot of crazies out yet. So getting to the venue is nice and fast, but kind of depending on how the layout is, how many people, how many entrances there are. I've heard horror stories of folks getting into some massive traffic. There was a 70.3, I think it was like 2 years ago. I forget exactly which one it was. I want to say it was somewhere in the Midwest, maybe Des Moines. I forget exactly though. But there were folks still waiting in traffic trying to get into the venue like when the race was supposed to start. And it was basically you had 2,000 or 3,000 athletes all being funneled into one entrance. And, you know, everybody kind of showed up around the same time and, it just kind of parking wasn't real easy and smooth. And, you know, you had a traffic jam, that backed up and it really threw everything off. I mean, they delayed the start of the race and all that, but, it's, you know, that's not how you want to start race morning. So take all those things into consideration.
Yeah, great stuff there, John. I'll just kind of speak to the local race because I remember signing up for my first couple local sprints put on by Dallas Athletes Racing and by PlayTri. The local races in Dallas-Fort Worth, most of them will offer a race morning packet pickup. Not all of them do. So when you're racing those local sprints and local Olympics, if you're used to having packet pickup days in advance, just know it might be their race morning. It might not be their race morning, but I always prefer if you can get to one of the packet pickups before race morning. It's just going to take one thing off your plate that you have to take care of on the morning of the race. If you wait for race morning, you've got to pick up that packet. You have to put your numbers on all the spots that are supposed to have your numbers. It just adds to your morning. Plus, it's another opportunity to just go and find out more about the race. Oftentimes at packet pickup, there is whoever's hosting the packet pickup will be knowledgeable about the race. They're usually knowledgeable about the course, and so you can ask any questions that you have. So I always recommend if you can get to a packet pickup in advance, always do that. John, you kind of implied the same thing. You're not a fan of waiting till race morning for those, but definitely something to be aware of. I was not aware that packet pickup was a thing until I signed up for my first triathlon. And thankfully, Dallas Athletes Racing sent out an email letting you know when the packet pickups were. I was like, oh, I have a packet to pick up. Got it. So anyway, definitely a fan of doing that. As you look at the race schedule, I mean, you can start to do the math on when or what time of day you might be on certain portions of the course. And at all distances, sprint all the way up to Ironman, there are implications for race strategy based on the timing of your race and the weather on the day. So talk to us about kind of tweaking our race strategy based on what we see on the race schedule.
I know we keep using this example of Ironman Texas, but it's happening in a few days. And I'm actually having this conversation with three of my athletes who are racing. Had it yesterday. And the weather is this huge question mark, as always in Texas. It can be 95 degrees out there towards the end of the bike and onto the run course. It can be direct sunlight, super hot, super windy, but it's actually looking like it might rain out there. It's also looking like it could be 50-something degrees in the morning. The water temperature for a while was, you know, probably hit or miss on if it is going to be wetsuit legal or not. But now it's like in the 60s. And so now it's like, well, goodness, I was going to use a sleeveless wetsuit, but if it's going to be that cold, maybe you want to bring that full sleeve just in case. And so things like that, adjusting, contingency plans and having everything set ahead of the time. Something to consider is it going to take 1 to 2 hours to get everyone in the water? Some races, especially open water, they can get everyone in there in 15 minutes and everyone starts at about 7 a.m. But if your wave is going to be 9 a.m. or some people are, well into the bike before you even get in the water, right? So something I talk about is like kind of like a second breakfast or a snack. Are you going to time your big meal a little bit different? Are you going to have another snack? If there is a weather delay or it takes a long time to get everyone in the water, you don't want to start feeling hungry and having those blood sugar issues and the race hasn't even started yet. So the timing of that and when you'll actually be in the water, just having those contingency plans. And then the last piece really is training the gut for the high end of the ranges and then tapering that down based on what the actual race day shows is another big one. So you'll do that with your pacing strategy and with your nutrition strategy based on what the day is going to throw at you.
So a consideration with weather is how is it going to change throughout the course of the event itself? Some climates are going to have drastic swings where you may have a very cool morning to start. When the sun rises, it could get warm quite quickly, and depending on time of year. So how is that going to affect those things? And then when we get into like Ironman racing, when you're out there from sunrise to sunset and then potentially beyond. We've been at numerous races where it has gotten quite hot in the afternoon, but then as the sun begins to set, the temperature really begins to drop. And that's where something like a long sleeve shirt or a jacket can really be useful in a personal needs bag that you have access to. And just kind of a little tip here, I've seen this many, many times on these real hot races where folks will get behind on hydration, they'll get overheated, and that's when people start to walk. But there's a little bit of hope in that sunset is coming. So that's kind of the tip I give those people in that moment when they're out there, they're maybe even on the first half of the run, they've got a long way to go, but maybe it's getting later in the afternoon. I always remind them to top off their fuel, get hydrated because the temperature has begun to drop. They're going to not be baking in the sun anymore. And if they do that right, then they can get back to running. They don't have to finish out walking. So just a little tip there on that is if you get overheated, if you get behind on hydration, go ahead and get topped off. And then once the temperatures drop, hopefully you'll be back to running.
Yeah, no, great, John. Jeff, something that you said that I wanted to touch a little bit more on is the fact that you often, just depending on the swim start, you know, the race starts at X o'clock. You know, you might be first into the water. You might be into the water in 20 minutes. You might be into the water in 45 minutes. You might be in the water a half hour or an hour and a half after the actual swim start. And so just knowing that and having nutrition available according to that is a great tip that I didn't want to overlook. And something I want to add to that is usually races should tell you what type of swim start it is. Is it wave starts where your wave is told, oh, you are going at 8:05, you are in the water. And so you know exactly how much time you have to kill. Is it a rolling start? And so if you're faster, you're getting into the water sooner. If you're slower, you're getting into the water a lot later. Is it a mass start? So just know what the swim start is like and then kind of do the math on how much time it's probably going to take before, if it is a rolling start, is it a race with 150 athletes and so everybody's in the water in 16 minutes? Or is it a race with 800 athletes where it's going to take a little bit longer? And so just knowing that how the race is going to start and how many swimmers there are is going to help you do that math on if you need a gel or some hydration just to kind of top your energy reserves up before the race starts.
A great example of that is age group nationals. The advantage is you will know what time your wave is going to go off. That is published, so you're going to know that. But there is a huge delta between that first group in the water and last group. I want to say it's something like 2.5 hours.
Wow.
So yeah, huge impact here, both on, as Jeff mentioned, your nutrition. Yeah, it's good to, you got to keep eating, you got to keep drinking in that time. You don't want to just fast and not take anything in for that 2.5 hours. And then chances are it's going to be considerably warmer 2.5 hours later in the day. That race is held in August, and even up there, up north where it's held, it's going to get hot. That's a huge variable to consider in that race.
Yeah. One other thing that I'll talk about just before I move on from the race schedule is on the race schedule, it's very important to note when transition is opening and when transition is closing. Often there's a couple hour window to kind of get your stuff done and get your stuff ready. Often it's a short window. But something to note is If I think most people aim towards the middle of that window, right? Because you don't want to be rushed at the end of the window, but you want to get as much sleep as you can get. So you don't want to be necessarily the first one there. And so what happens is there's this huge influx of people kind of right in the middle of the range. And so if you know that, I mean, just it's fine, but maybe you err on going a little bit earlier than you want to, just to make sure it's not, you're not super rushed. Or if you're fine, if you know what you're doing and you're in and out really quickly, you know, you can kind of risk it and take a little bit longer. But just note how much time you have there, and just keep in mind, most people are going to target kind of the middle of that window. And so depending on how big the race is and how much stuff you have to accomplish, kind of plan your time accordingly. So a couple more questions, guys. We're going to blitz through these. So a thorough athlete guide will also give the layout of the race venue. I mean, things like where the athlete check-in is, the expo, transition, orientation, VIP areas, any potential local amenities for your family members and Sherpas. What do we need to know about the actual host venue to make sure we are prepared for the race experience?
I would say the most important thing here, and this is going to vary from individual to individual, is make sure you're not overdoing it. A lot of times there are really cool expos, villages, things going on down there at the host. And it's certainly possible to kind of overdo it, take too many steps, expend too much energy, get behind on your nutrition, your hydration, especially if it's warm out, spending too much time in the sun. That's going to zap you and not really set you up for the next day. So again, kind of plan accordingly. This is why I always recommend doing those things early on. So check in, go into the village, those things like that. Get those done earlier in the day, earlier in the week as you can. And then especially as those hours and days lead into the race, those become more and more valuable to really rest up, stay off your feet as much as possible. Make sure you're up on your energy, your nutrition, your hydration.
An even more thorough athlete guide will show some key logistics for the host city. So we're kind of expanding the circle from where the race is to the actual city itself that is hosting the event. They'll highlight things like the host hotels, key parking areas, and more. What info is helpful here? What do we need to absorb?
A lot of times some real important information is where not to park. That's often a thing where a lot of these races are in kind of urban areas, and there's definitely yeses and nos. Sometimes you've got a great parking lot or a field or something where it's super easy. Others, you know, you're somewhat fending for yourself. Once you've gone out and raced 140.6 miles, had a great race, you've gone and picked up your bike and you go to put it in your car and your car has been towed or ticketed, that's definitely going to be a blemish on your awesome day. So make sure that you're knowing where to park and where not to. And then I think another thing is good locations to eat, get groceries, last minute supplies.
Yeah, great point, John. And finding, thinking through, what are you eating the night before? What are you eating the morning of? Is that taking some groceries with you, getting some groceries on site? Definitely think through what are the food options where you are. When I did my first half Ironman in New Zealand, when it's an away game, right? When you're not in your hometown, you got to find what is the brand of grocery store that is in this city that I'm going to be at, and what do they sell? Yeah, always an adventure, always something to think through as you're looking at the host city itself. I think I hit the highlights for what a race athlete guide should cover. We've talked about the race site logistics, the race city logistics, the race schedule, the course maps, you know, all that kind of stuff. But there certainly can be more info included in a good athlete guide. I mean, these things are often at the big box races. There are pages and pages of information. I've seen letters from the race director. I've seen offers from race sponsors. I've seen coupons to local vendors and all sorts of other things. What else have you guys seen an athlete guide include that can help us nail race weekend?
Food vouchers, or like you said, local vendors or attractions. Sometimes there'll be coupons. Things like that could be gold. Let's say I'm racing, but my wife and kids are on site. Well, what are they going to do for 5-6 hours while I'm on the bike? Those race athlete guides will have some of those vouchers or coupon codes and things like that. And I guess the last thing to really consider, and something we could have mentioned before, is, you know, the bike course usually covers a lot of real estate. If you're going to do a local attraction, make sure it's in maybe the opposite direction of what the bike course is going to be, so there's easy access, stuff like that.
Yeah, probably just in general, Jeff. I mean, when we go spectate and we're cheering on trotted athletes at some of these major events, it is very, very crucial to know where the routes are, what roads are going to be closed. Is it, I mean, some venues, it's pretty easy to get in and out as a spectator. Some venues, you go down there and you stay down there because it's not easy to get in and out and it's not easy to get around. So certainly knowing which is the case and preparing the family for the day is super helpful. So that's a great point there. One thing I'll add is there are some races where they actually have YouTube videos and video elements that can help you prepare for the race. Escape from Alcatraz is such an interesting, challenging race that they have very, very good videos kind of pointing out crucial things you need to know about the course. But even if you go on YouTube and just Google Ironman Texas Swim Course or this local Olympic triathlete, oftentimes there's just an average Joe triathlete who has put out some sort of a video that can kind of give you some insights to the course. So always just go to Google and punch in the name of your race and see what might be out there. You'll never know what you'll find that could be helpful.
Great set, everyone. Let's cool down.
It's cool down time, and I'm Vanessa, your average triathlete with elite level enthusiasm. For our coach cool down tip today, we have a very special guest in the house whose specialty is teaching about the caves we reside in and the masks that we wear. Jason McFall is a tenured professor of English in Walnut, California, and his other passion involves triathlon training in Chino Hills State Park, which happens to be right outside his back door. He comes from a strong athletic pedigree, as his dad was a bike racer and his mom a marathoner, which allows us all to have a better understanding of how he has 34 full distance tri finishes and 2 Kona qualifications to his name, how he qualified for a pro card in 2014, and also holds a Boston Marathon finish time of 2:59:30. Jason has been coaching the sport of triathlon for over a decade, with athletes finishing their first triathlons all the way to those getting PRs at 70.3s and full distance Ironmans, in addition to Kona qualifiers. He has been coaching with TriDot for almost 2 years, and his specialty is sports psychology. One of his magical powers as a coach is turning run haters into run lovers. Welcome to the show, Jason.
Thanks, Vanessa. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's really exciting to have you here, and I can't even begin to tell you how much I want to hear about this little fact that not many people know about you, because anything that involves chocolate cake is right up my alley. So apparently the story is that you had a negative association with mile 80 of a bike ride. So to conquer this, you would stash a piece of chocolate cake in your jersey and reward yourself for getting past this mental barrier. So I think I need to know a little bit more about this.
So I would go on a lot of long bike rides, and I kept noticing that around miles 75, 76, 77, 78, and this, it was most pronounced at mile 80, I would get dejected. I would get almost sad. No. I would get frustrated. I would get angry. And none of these things were consistent with the emotions I wanted to have when I was on my bike and when I was doing this kind of training. And so I tried a lot of different things and nothing seemed to work for me. And then I was at Costco and I had an aha moment when I saw there just enormous chocolate cake. And I thought, you know, I like chocolate cake and that would be a good reward for me, something I could associate with mile 80. And so I could take a slice of that, put it into a Ziploc bag, keep it in my jersey pocket. And then that is something that I could have, you know, when I get to mile 80, I look at my Garmin and sure enough, like 79.9 and then 80, boom, I get my chocolate cake. And so I did that for the first time and it worked. And, you know, I started thinking a lot of negative thoughts and things at mile 71, 72. And then that other voice went, hey, you've got chocolate cake. Chocolate cake in your back pocket. So it was great. And it was kind of my go-to for a while. And then on one ride, once it had become normal for me, I was riding with my friend Roy and he didn't know anything about this chocolate cake. And we're at mile 80. And so for me now, it was business as usual. I get to have my chocolate cake. And so I just, you know, we're in arrow position. We're riding two abreast. And I reach back and I get my chocolate cake and I'm squeezing it out of the Ziploc bag. And, you know, and it's delicious and he doesn't notice anything. And then we both go over this bump in the road and I smash the cake right in my face. So I've got the frosting hanging from my nose and I've got bits of cake, you know, all over my cheeks. And that's when he looks
of
over
course.
And he says, what are you doing? Are you eating cake? I just, my mouth was full. I was just kind of like, oh,
I love that.
And yeah, but it you know, it worked and it changed my association with that mile 80 marker.
That is a fabulous idea. And it changes your perception of mile 80 from being one of potential dread to being something to actually look forward to and to get exactly. excited about. So aside from stashing chocolate cake in our bike jerseys as motivation, what tip do you have for us all today?
It's about friction and it dovetails really nicely with the chocolate cake story. The way I'm using friction is deliberately increasing or decreasing resistance in an effort to reach our true potential. So for example, with the chocolate cake story, there was mounting friction when I was biking and I knew that, oh, I'm almost at, you know, now I'm at mile 70, now 72, 74, 76, I'm getting closer to 80 and 80 is when I fall apart. Right. And so there was kind of mounting resistance keeping me from what I wanted to accomplish as an athlete. What could I do to lower the friction? It's one of the best things about Tri-Dot is that biology scales. So we can periodize training and we can say, look, you're a human being. This is going to work for you. Right. With personality, it's a little bit different. Personality doesn't scale. So, you know, for me, it's chocolate cake. For somebody else, it might be something else. But for the people listening to this, we can start really simple with friction. So let's say, for instance, a person is not getting enough sleep, which is a lot of us typically, right? So then it's, okay, well, what's the culprit? Or what's one of the things leading to the lack of sleep? And maybe it's something as simple as I'm watching too much TV. I I turn on the TV with the remote and I just plan on watching it for 30 minutes and 3 hours later, I'm still there. That happens to a lot of us. And in that case, there are different things you could do to add friction. So to increase friction, something as simple as taking the batteries out of the remote control when you finish. And you don't have to hide them, right? It's not an Easter egg hunt or anything. You just pop them in a drawer or put them in your dresser upstairs, but just make it inconvenient enough. Add that small layer of friction so that tomorrow night when you sit down and you just habitually go to press the power button on the remote, you go, dang it, I don't have any batteries, right? And then it's just enough to slow you down, give you pause, and give you space to ask yourself the question, is this really what I want to do? Right? Because our discipline drops so much toward the end of the day, we get exhausted.
Yeah.
And so we end up making some bad decisions. So these are just little things. For me, it wasn't about getting enough sleep. I wasn't getting high quality sleep often. And it was because I like beer. I like to drink beer and I like to drink red wine. And then I sometimes make bad nutritional decisions after I've had a beer or two or a glass or two of wine. And so, you know, back in the olden days, the Garmins that we used were the one that I had was called the 910 and it didn't have the sensor. And so it didn't provide the same metrics, but like, for instance, with the new Garmins, like my 945 has an optical sensor. This was the best layer of friction that I could introduce because I got addicted to body battery and sleep score. So now it's really easy for me to say no. The beer can say, hey, drink me. And I can go, you know what? I don't want to wake up and look at my body battery and see that it's 17, and that's just enough to give me pause. And sometimes that's all we need.
No, I 100% agree with you. Even just with the sleep and the alcohol, I do not drink alcohol very often. But I notice when I do, like once every few months, my HRV status just plummets, it's so crazy and to be able to understand that before I choose or not to choose to have alcohol, it's like, do I want my HRV to drop that much? And the answer is often no, right? Like I just don't want to jeopardize that extra, bit of recovery and all that biological stuff that's happening in the body. I just don't want to really have it affect it. So it makes the choice a lot easier.
Right. Well, and one of the smartest things is that you ask yourself that question also. Right? Because our brains love questions. And so if you say, do you want this to happen? And your brain goes, no, it helps make that decision for you.
Yeah, 100%.
Thanks for joining us. Make sure to subscribe and share the TriDot podcast with your triathlon crew. For more great Tri content and community, connect with us on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram. Ready to optimize your training? Head to TriDot.com and start your free trial today. TriDot, the obvious and automatic choice for triathlon training.